thing we have to fear is fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, a biweekly discussion of how digital media and technology are affecting learning, teaching, and scholarship at colleges, universities, libraries, and museums. This is Digital Campus number 42 for the 21st of May, 2009, The Real World. I'm Dan Cohen. And it's time for the Digital Campus episode that Wolfram Alpha, the new computational knowledge engine at wolframalpha.com, says is the answer to the meaning of life. It's 42, episode 42 of our podcast. I'm Dan Cohen. Welcome to our audience, new and old. And welcome back to the panel, of course, our regulars and co-hosts here, Tom Scheinfeld from foundhistory.org and at foundhistory on Twitter. Hey, Tom.
Hi, guys. Great to be back.
Yeah, good to be back. We'll have to hear about your baby in just a second. And, of course, Mills Kelly. Hey, Mills from edwired.org and fake at Edwired on Twitter, of course. Hey, Mills.
How are you? It's good to be back.
Good. Good to have you. We're welcoming Tom back to the podcast after a paternal leave. How is paternity there?
Paternity is interesting. It's sleepless. It's a lot of fun, though, and we're having a really good time with Luke. I was so thrilled that you guys got Stan Katz on in my stead last time, and I'm sort of thinking he did such a great job that maybe I should bow out permanently. But put it this way, I'm glad that you had me back after Stan.
Right.
I'm glad that you still wanted me back.
You'll be getting your pink slip from the podcast soon, Tom. Stan was really excellent. So
there is a recession after all. So
yeah, it is quite a downturn, and our podcast with no budget is increasingly tight these days.
Okay, so we need to ask the Digital Campus new parent quiz. Question number one, have you bought a domain name for Luke Scheinfeld?
No, have not. But I have thought about it. I just haven't gotten around to it.
Okay.
It's changing diapers. But as soon as I get a minute, I'm going to.
Okay, question number two, have you reserved his Twitter name?
Have not. Again, the link.
Okay. We'll leave it at that.
I'll take it no further. Getting this parenting thing down.
Focus on the diapers first and then the domain name next.
Yeah, I think that's my plan.
Okay, sounds very good. Well, welcome back to everyone. We're delighted to have you here. And I was joking at the beginning about this Wolfram Alpha, which I did type in. Boy, it's a mouthful, isn't it? Wolfram Alpha. What is the meaning of life? Of course, it answers from the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, 42. And I actually typed in just before the podcast, what is Digital Campus? And Wolfram Alpha says, I'm not sure what to do with your input, Dave. Would you like to explore sports and games instead? Your initial reactions to this computational knowledge engine that everyone is chatting about as maybe the answer to homework?
I think it's going to sink like a stone. You can't get the answer to much of anything from it. And I mean, the most I played with it for 15 minutes at lunch today, and I asked it many questions, and I would say probably 95% of those questions came back with, Wolfram Alpha doesn't know what to do with your question. Okay, it's like if you turn on a radio station and there's no sound coming out, you assume that they're off the air. Well, it seems to me that Wolfram Alpha is kind of off the air in terms of providing information.
Yeah, my problem with it is that I think it has a few problems. I think the biggest problem right now is possibly a design problem. When you go to the Wolfram Alpha homepage, you're given what looks a lot like a Google search box. It's a kind of a right on the top of the page, a single long, 600 pixel wide search box. And so from a user interface perspective, says to me that I should just type in, a freeform question. And when I do that, I get back a bunch of nonsense. It doesn't have the answer to my question. Whatever it spits back is usually not the answer to what I'm looking for. And the problem with that is that's not really how you're supposed to use Wolfram Alpha. And if you kind of read further down the page, it gives you all these hints for how to structure your query. So it's basically a knowledge engine, a computational engine that uses structured data to answer structured queries. If that's the case, then the user interface should reflect that. If I'm supposed to be giving it a structured query, then the user interface needs to help me do that. I can't just be led to believe that I can type in something the way I would type in something to Google and be given a set of results. That should be explicit in the interface. So I think that at least I'm hoping that's the big problem with this new computational engine, and that once they kind of fix the UI problems, it will have some potential for answering kind of queries about structured data, not natural language queries, but things about statistics and other kinds of more let's say scientific or more numerical queries.
Yeah, it doesn't really make much sense as a kind of general engine. I could see this being laid on top of, let's say, a particular archive or set of data that you might want to mine, and that you would have a kind of restricted domain of or set of queries to act against it, in the same way that structured query language, SQL, which is used on most databases, kind of knows already what the columns are and kind of allows you to, in sort of a quasi-English, to say, you know, exactly what you want to get out of it. You know, it's interesting because, I experimented with this idea of a kind of homework search engine a few years back with Simon Kornblith, really talented programmer who's at Caltech now. And, we tried pulling a lot of information like this, like figuring out when someone was born and grabbing web information and kind of distilling it down. I think they've ended up in exactly the same place, which is you end up using Wikipedia a lot because you can get a lot of data out of that. And the general web, you can't just rely on what's there. You have to do some statistical processing on it and to kind of distill down what the facts are, to grab it from many pages and to kind of figure out the validity of pages. And it ends up being really tricky. And so the process, I think, of just the general Google search engine, where you end up with a set of results and you kind of scan with your eye for a page that provides, you know, what you would consider a reliable source, is actually not a bad way for answering most things. I suppose they're going to add a lot of visualizations and things like that you can't get out of Google. But I did find it interesting that Google, I think, feels some pressure from this, in that they had this presentation of exciting things going on in Google Search Labs, where they had something called Google Squared. Did you two see this? The release of Google Squared, where it was...
Oh, I did see this, yeah.
Yeah, where, again, it was a kind of database thing, and they categorized types of dogs and, you know, had little structured bits of data about that dachshunds are prevalent in New York City and things like that. And I think it's because they feel like... you know, there's all these math PhDs at Google, and they need to feel like they're on the absolute cutting edge. And so, clearly this really smart guy comes along with his company and Wolfram, who, if you don't know about him, but he's done a lot of work also in basically the theory of science and his emphasis on algorithms as a kind of key part of science and developing scientific theory. And so that, you know, they want to feel that they're out in front and that they're not just the domain of the 10 blue links, as Yahoo recently disparaged them as.
I actually think that another question that I think Wolfram Alpha raises is whether it's really the algorithm anymore that sort of determines a search engine's dominance, that determines Google's market dominance and its superiority. Because, I mean, one of the things that I searched on was life expectancy at birth in England in 1900. And there, after restructuring my query a couple times, it did give me the answer. I did the same thing for the United States, and the closest it could get was 1933. It couldn't get me the answer for 1900, and that essentially, it's not that it didn't understand the query, it's that it didn't have the data on hand. And so the question then becomes, well, so you've got this super sophisticated algorithm that can, you know, take my query and run it on a set of data and come back with an answer. Well, if you don't have the data, then you're not going to, no matter how good the algorithm is, you're not going to give me the answer. And I wonder if Google now is just so far out ahead in terms of amassing and aggregating, you know, loads and loads and loads of data, whether anybody's really ever going to be able to catch up in that respect. Like, they've now got, you know, so much data to run their queries on that even if their algorithm is, you know, slightly less sophisticated, or it's not as, it doesn't deal quite as well with more statistical data, structured data, whether that even matters anymore, because they've just got that mass of raw data at hand.
Yeah, you know, this is a point that I kind of picked up. Murr Rosenzweig and I wrote a piece on data on the web, or an article called Web of Lies, Historical Knowledge on the Internet. And one of the points that we made in that article, we'll post a link to this from the digitalcampus.tv website, was that, you know, historical facts actually change more than you'd imagine. And the one that we brought up was the year that Alexander Hamilton was born, which you'd think would be an established date. And but it's actually changed recently. The most common year that used to be mentioned was 1755, but now most historians believe, at least in the last 5 to 10 years, most historians now think he was actually born in 1757. You think you'd have a founder of the United States' birthday or birth year pinned down by this point. But what's interesting about this is that Google actually has the means of picking up the fact that that date changed, because if you look at the an index of pages that mention Alexander Hamilton's birth, they're slowly evolving from listing 1755 to 1757. And you can kind of do a statistical analysis on that and realize that something's up because of the spikes on these dates. And so I think Google has always been based upon the fact that quantity beats quality. They'd rather have the kind of messiness, the kind of web as it is, in its aggregate, in its enormity, and that they could mine a lot of data straight out of that, rather than having, let's say, the specific census records, which is, I'm sure, what the structured data is that Wolfram Alpha uses for these life expectancy queries. So they'd rather have that kind of scale versus quote-unquote kind of vetted sources, pinned down sources, because of the fact that things do change.
And I think this model where, you know, Google does 99% of the work for you, and then it expects you to do the last 1% on your own. Like, it gives you the top 10 results, and from those, you know, you can find something that's going to be useful to you, or you can at least follow one of those links to another link that's going to be. And I think, you know, the question of, do we really need the exact answer to most queries? And especially, I guess if we were scientists, we may have a different perspective on this. But for humanists who deal with, you know, a lot of gray and are used to dealing with a lot of gray, and in fact, who, you know, want to be dealing with the gray areas, not the necessarily the hard, cold numbers, I wonder if something like Google isn't good enough for us.
Right? Yeah, I mean, I tried a sort of a natural language search, and, you know, got all kinds of screwy answers, you know, from Wolfram Alpha, because it's just clearly not designed to do that. So then I thought, okay, I'll be a little more fair, you know, I'll try to play in the sandbox that it's designed to play in. And so my search term was, since I do Habsburg kinds of history, Austrian, Czech, Slovak, Hungary population. All right. Well, so I got a reasonable outcome from that you wouldn't have gotten from Google. So, you know, it gives you the population of these four countries, which one has the highest, which one has the lowest, what their ratios are in comparison to each other, what's their growth rate, life expectancies, comparisons. You know, so it's a little more useful. So if you needed something for a paper about population in that part of Central Europe, you could get something pretty useful. But if you go to the source information, this is where I think they've got all kinds of problems, is that they – you know, it says primary source, their curated data. Okay, that's a very expensive proposition to curate this kind of data. And so then you look at the list of background sources and references. Okay, they've got a nice long source list, and at the bottom is the Wikimedia Foundation. And so you immediately wonder, well, did they get it from there, or the World Tourism Organization, or the United States Department of State background notes, or you know, where did it come from? You can't say. It's just some conglomeration of those things. And so on the one hand, on the surface, it's, you know, it's kind of useful, but I would never cite that result that I just got on population in this area. I would never cite it in something that I was writing, ever.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. I mean, you have, much like an academic resource, it at least says, you know, here are my sources. But in a sense, I mean, a lot of people aren't going to click on that link at the bottom of the page of the search results. And so it has the kind of patina of an academic publication, but it does have a lot of Wikipedia stuff in there. And I wonder if it's just better to tell a student, well, you know, okay, at least you know you're getting it from Wikipedia and you know the problems that that might have. You know, Wolfram Alpha, you're getting it from a scientist with his big computers, and so it's got to be right. And I wonder if that's a kind of worse proposition. Well, speaking of possibly fake results, have you guys been following this Elsevier scandal with this bogus journal that they created for Merck, the giant pharmaceutical company? They had this Australasian Journal of Bone and Joint Medicine. And now it seems like they're uncovering at least six other fake journals that they've turned out. So I think it wasn't just Merck, but I'll link to this article. There's several journals that are now kind of being looked at, which basically publish, you know, drug articles. And so they can be used to kind of bolster advertising claims by big pharmaceutical companies. It looks like, well, let me find this, but while I'm getting your reactions, here's another case where you'd think anything you'd find on an Elsevier search engine would be, you know, fact. What are we to make of this? Is this just an outlier?
It's really hard to say. I mean, when I saw the story, I thought, okay, there's just this one instance. And so some editor within their organization kind of went rogue on them, and it's a big sprawling operation at Reed Elsevier. And so there wasn't proper editorial control, and this thing happened. But now, as it appears that more and more of these journals are under their imprint, then it starts to look like an actual policy.
Yeah, there was kind of a drip to this story where, you know, one came out and then a couple more came out, and I think you know, if any more come out, I think this is going to turn into something really big. And if I was a publisher, scientific journals, I would be scouring my titles and my editorial boards to make sure to double check that there weren't any conflicts in funding and in editorial control and things, because I think this is the kind of thing that could really discredit a label. I think it could be a big problem, and I imagine these journals are not easily going to come back from this hit.
Well, yeah, so. and the scientist who then cited work published in a reputable journal in their own work, okay, they have to go back now and republish what they did and say, okay, I assumed that this was reasonable research because I found it in a Reed Elsevier journal, and it turns out it was just baloney.
Well, and in their defense, I will say that it hasn't been determined that the research itself is baloney. It's just that it's tainted. It may be baloney.
Yes, tainted is a better word than baloney.
Yeah, it'd be decent research. It's just that it's sponsored by companies that have a special interest in that particular research result. Whether the research result itself is bogus or not is another question.
Right. It looks like a lot of these. So I found the article. It's in The Guardian, the UK newspaper, The Guardian. And it looks like they did actually have a set of these journals that were basically just sort of reprints of other articles. That they sort of published together with maybe some glosses on it and a new cover and things like that. But clearly it's the kind of thing that it's sort of a marketing-shaped journal rather than a science-based journal, which really is pretty damaging, seems to me. Let's continue our – this is the fake versus real, I guess, episode of Digital Campus. The MPAA going up and saying that teachers should videotape monitors rather than break the DVD encryption to get videos into the classroom. Does this make any sense here? I guess the reason for this is that there's this, I don't know, I can't remember if it's annual or biannual set of hearings to look at for exemptions in the DMCA, the copyright law that we have here in the United States. That's relatively harsh in terms of what you can do with materials that are encrypted for digital rights management, like DVDs. And I guess some people are trying to get an exemption or continue an exemption to allow teachers to rip DVDs or get clips of movies off to show to their students for educational purposes. MPAA says, take your camera, set it up in front of a TV, and shoot away. Thoughts?
Yeah, seems like a silly thing to recommend. I mean, there is this kind of accepted exemption, this kind of analog hole, they call it, which would allow you to do something like tape a CD. You could move a CD to a tape and then pass that to your friend. That's an old exemption in the copyright law, which still exists. And so what the MPAA is saying is if you're a teacher and you want to post a video online, a clip of a video online, let's say to your blog for your students, instead of just ripping the DVD and posting that clip to your blog, even if it's access to that blog's controlled, if it's a password protected blog, then instead of doing that, you should set up your camcorder in front of a TV and basically make an analog recording of the screen and then post that to your class website. Seems silly. I mean, it seems like they should just either just one or the other, like just say we don't approve of this practice at all, or say, you know, go ahead and do this for educational purposes. This middle ground where they're trying to appeal to teachers and to make people think they're doing the right thing, and then but to not allow the easy way seems crazy.
Yeah, it's either okay to copy their stuff or it's not.
Right.
And so apparently it is okay as long as you do it in this really low tech and, you know, poor resolution mode. It's like saying that it's okay to go to a concert and record the band or the symphony with the recording device in your cell phone camera, you know, I mean, and get this really scratchy kind of low tech recording, but that's okay. And it just seems crazy to me. And further, almost nobody's going to do it that way. If teachers are going to reuse content, they're going to reuse the content. And if they've been told to go through this whole series of steps just to reuse the content, they won't. It's just too much trouble.
Isn't this so? It's not biannual. It's actually triennial. So every 3 years, the Copyright Office sort of hosts this forum for rulemaking about DMCA. This is just a crazy system, isn't it? That every 3 years, film historians or teachers who want to use films are going to have to re-justify this. I just don't understand why. I mean, clearly it's part of the law, but this seems like a convoluted process itself to have to justify all these things every 3 years. And undoubtedly, there will be new forms of digital rights management and encryption, etc. So this will just be a kind of academic version of the cat and mouse game that goes on in the world of piracy, won't it?
Well, I think it's a function of the DMCA being such a restrictive law, where if you're going to have really restrictive laws on a technology that is constantly changing, you need to look at it every 3 years and say, okay, what are the new holes that have opened up? What are the new what are the new practices, the new piracy practices, the new technologies that allow piracy that have developed during the past 3 years that allow people to get around or to exploit loopholes in the law? If the copyright regime weren't so restrictive, you wouldn't need a review of these things, because these things would be, many of them, permitted, and it would be clear. So I think it's just this, as you say, a cat and mouse game where publishers are just constantly trying to keep up with this changing technology, which, if it ever changes, it always changes in the direction of increasing access, of increasing portability, of increasing openness. And so it just it has to be this way, and it's just ridiculous, and it's inherently ridiculous, I think.
Well, I think you're right, Tom. I mean, isn't this exactly what's happened? We haven't had a chance to discuss it yet on the podcast, but with the new Amazon Kindle DX, really the big news is not just the form factor, that it's larger and might be better for things like textbooks. And of course, they did announce that they would have textbook publishers as sort of buy-in to the system, but also that it supports PDFs, right? So I assume we are headed down the road where there will be probably textbooks that are photocopied and stuck up on PDFs on the web. They're probably there already if we looked around. And if you had a Amazon Kindle DX, which granted right now is out of the price range for most students, but one would assume it will come down. Are we going to get to the point that the publishers of textbook are going to have to go in front of the copyright office and argue that students will have to get a Kindle DX, get the PDF, take a photograph of the Kindle DX on each page, and then use those for readings? Are we going to end up with more and more Rube Goldberg contraptions to go forward with education?
I mean, I think the good news is for one sort of segment of the industry here is that the copying industry, meaning like Xerox and Canon and people like that, they have a bright future for at least the next few years, because teachers aren't going to do what you just described. Students aren't going to do what you just described. Instead, for educational purposes, they're still going to take that textbook or that book of sources or whatever it is down to the office and copy off 20 copies of that one primary source that's not online and is in a book, and they're going to hand it out to their students, because that's what they have to do, because they don't have other kinds of workarounds and they can't do it other ways.
You know, it just strikes me that this PDF reading, it's really you can imagine a lot of copiers actually right now, Mills. I mean, they'll take a scan too and they'll email it to you. So it's just not that complicated to get a lot of this stuff up for free. I'm sure these publishers must be a little freaked out by this. But I guess this could happen right now. I mean, on any netbook, on any notebook, desktop machine, you can find a PDF and read it on that device. I guess it just makes it a little bit more visible, right? That all of a sudden now there's really a kind of market for pirated book materials.
And I think the Kindle, because it's a, from all I've heard, and I've played with them a little bit, but from all I've heard, it is really a much more comfortable, much more kind of lean back reading experience, whereas I think the computer is kind of a lean forward reading experience. This is a distinction they make between TV and the computer, where you kind of lean back and watch TV and you lean forward and read and look at video on your computer. The Kindle is sort of the same way, where you kind of lean back in bed and read something on your Kindle. I think that publishers were a little insulated from it, because they knew people weren't going to really do a ton of reading on their computers or on their netbook. I mean, you'd have to kind of turn the netbook on its side even to make it feel a little like a book. With the Kindle, all of a sudden, like, this really does replace in many ways the print copy. And I expect to be hearing a lot more from publishers about this PDF feature as Kindles make their way onto campus next semester.
Seems like a pretty easy way now to set up your own press, isn't there? I mean, if that form factor, if something like the Kindle DX really takes off, and you can assume that there's a lot of them circulating in academia, and you're an academic press, or you're just a academic press in the basement of one person, pretty easy to produce PDFs.
Pretty easy
to distribute them. You could use some, I learned a great term from Peter Brantley, you could use some social DRM. So you could let people download PDFs that have their, purchased by Dan Cohen scrolled along the bottom. So if they in turn circulate it around, that they were distributing it illegally. And you could charge a lot less, right, than the current textbook.
Absolutely. I think it's just going to get easier and easier to do this kind of thing. And then people are going to find instructors are going to find the books that they like, or the pieces of books that they like, and they're going to put them together into something simple and easy to use and pretty inexpensive.
Yeah, I remember the source books that, we were forced to buy as an undergraduate, the compilations of photocopies that were bound together and sold in the basement of the science building on campus. You know, why not do that now and put it on a Kindle? And the instructors can do it, and they're going to, because it's just a lot easier than going through the university administration, which I'm sure offices on campuses will be set up to do this for faculty members. But, you know, and that was convenient in years past when actually these things had to be copied and bound and expensive. Now it's simple. And I could, you know, just compile a PDF source pack and give it to my students. And that would be that. I think, you know, it'll be very interesting to see towards the end of the fall semester where this has gone.
You know, Cliff Lynch of the Coalition for Network Information, I was in a meeting with him. He made this really striking point, which wasn't directly related to the new Kindle, but you could see its impact on an environment where you had a lot of Kindle-like devices. He was making this point that when you look at the textbook market, there's really only about 50 courses in at least in American universities, but I assume this applies globally as well. But there's about 50 courses that are really kind of profitable textbook areas. So they're things like, you know, American History 101, Econ 101, these sorts of courses. And there's only about 50 of them in the entire university structure. And he was saying that, you know, a lot of foundations and other groups have kind of studied this problem, that if you came up with an open source textbook, let's say in PDF, for the sake of the Kindle DX, if you somehow were able to fund, you know, 50 decent quality textbooks in those fields, you could save the entire education system, you know, literally billions of dollars over, you know, a decade or more, because you would, you know, you'd effectively have those things available, easily distributed, et cetera. It just hasn't happened yet, but you can imagine the power of that idea, that you could basically short circuit the entire textbook market and save the educational system enormous amounts of money with just a kind of surgical strike on open access, let's say PDF versions of text.
Well, I saw recently in an article on Ars Technica, and I missed this on any of the blogs and papers that higher education kind of websites that I read, but it was on Ars Technica that California is looking to do this for its primary and secondary education, where it's the governor of California has tasked the Secretary of Education with developing a set of digital open source textbooks for math and science that will be free and used across the state, and they want these ready for for fall 2009. I think that's fairly ambitious, but the idea would be that these things would save the state of California tons and tons of money in the cost of buying books, and you know, sort of your standard algebra textbook is not something that, you know, the information is the same and across all of these textbooks. It's fairly standardized. The way it's taught is fairly standardized, and there doesn't seem like it needs to be proprietary. It could be open source. I think, at least according to this article, that they're running into problems with state standards and how do you evaluate this open source textbook, which presumably will change over time. How do you make sure it is that this changing, growing thing is always current with state standards? What's the evaluation? Who do you go to if changes need to be made, if the curriculum changes, those kinds of things? But
right, those are good questions. Yeah,
but it is something I think that's being tried, and I think if the California public schools manage to replace their math and science textbooks with something open source, wow, watch out, that's when things will really change.
Yeah, you know, I mean, this whole landscape is changing really rapidly. I don't know if you, the two of you, saw that Scribd now has a store for PDFs. So if you're an author, you can post a PDF to Scribd, is spelled S-C-R-I-B-D, leave out the E, .com. And they've got now a section that's basically just a store that you can imagine hooking up to pretty much any device, mobile, netbook, Kindle type device, and you can sell it for anything you want and keep 80% of the profit. So there's also a market developing here again for kind of easy to distribute, open, quasi-open access, maybe with social DRM type material. I think it points some interesting directions for academic presses and other kinds of publications on that side as well, huh? Well, let's see. Lots of other stories to get to. More on the Google Books. We just actually had an announcement just today. We're recording on Wednesday, May 20th, 2009. And University of Michigan actually has announced a kind of revised settlement digitization agreement with Google. And we're just getting the details in this right now via Twitter and other means. So we haven't completely processed it. But what does seem like what's happening, and again, we'll post the agreement here on our website, is that effectively the University of Michigan has gotten Google to sort of explicitly agree to considerable more, and I think, obviously allowable kinds of public domain uses of the books that are being scanned as part of the collaboration between Google and University of Michigan, and that in the most obvious case are showing up at Google Books, but also that University of Michigan is now putting into HathiTrust, which I believe we've discussed before on the podcast, a kind of digital library storehouse that a bunch of about a dozen large-scale research universities in the Midwest, and as well as I think Berkeley, have joined together to kind of have a digital book repository. So they're now allowing for kind of expanded opportunities to provide users with access to these books. They secured some rights to, it sounds to me like, for instance, create audio versions for people with who are blind to access these books that have been scanned, to provide greater access for scholars who want to do kind of computational studies of the entire corpus of, it's now approaching 8 million digitized books. It seems to me, now as the settlement is going on, that the settlement between Google and the American Association of Publishers, as that's going on, I guess now these libraries are getting into the business of kind of fine-tuning the agreements that probably they launched without maybe fully thinking through or fully foreseeing what would happen with this digitization project with Google. Is that how the two of you read this?
I think this is a good example of why it wasn't a bad idea to wait a little bit, because I think the University of Michigan has created a much better arrangement for the use and reuse of this material than was the case in the original scanning process.
Yeah, I wonder if it has something to do with the way if Google is sort of sensing some public backlash to the settlement, and that maybe some of the public backlash is going to influence the judge's decision, and they're trying to show that there's, even with the settlement coming out, that there'll be some flexibility and there'll be still be some ways to improve access for various audiences. And I just wonder if some of this isn't sort of PR. It's hard to say. It's an impossible claim to prove. But it just seems like the timing is all. There's been a lot of. So Brewster Kahle had an op-ed in the Washington Post, I guess yesterday, decrying the Google Book settlement. And I'm just wondering, and urging the judge to reject it. I'm just wondering if some of this, if the timing seems like a little suspicious. But who knows.
Yeah, I mean, if you read through here, it says that the agreement expands the scope of the partnership to broaden public access, support shared services with other libraries, provide greater access to students and faculty, so that people at the University of Michigan can get a digital copy of every book in the collection, whether it's scanned at Michigan or another library. And that you can share public domain books. It seems like they're almost reassuring everyone that, yes, you know, this stuff, we're going to be able to make maximal use of this stuff, and that there's not going to be some hidden agreement with Google where we won't be able to do what we'd normally be able to do with what, after all, is in many cases public domain works. You know, they're ensuring these things that probably should have been surfaced maybe earlier on. Again, we're talking a little bit ahead of ourselves here, since we haven't seen the full amendment, and we will get that posted to the site when we have it. Actually, I'm now just getting it across Twitter. Ah, the wonders of Twitter. Okay, so there's now an amendment that they've released, and again, I'll post directly this PDF. And it looks like, wow, this is the amendment. Are you ready for this? Is 36 pages of legalese. that's been released just now.
Only well, that reassures me.
Yeah, I feel much better.
Now I know exactly how I'm permitted to use these.
Okay, so I'm you know right. So here I am live scanning this on. Thank you. I can't remember who that was. It just direct messaged me the actual PDF on Twitter. It looks like now they're just sort of clarifying how, for instance, they'll review what pricing gets done for access to things that aren't in the public domain. It makes a little clearer how they're going to provide access to these works for people with disabilities, which I guess maybe wasn't as clear. I guess maybe that's something that kind of came up when, or that maybe Amazon was blindsided by when you know, they had to turn off the audio for books because of the publishers were sort of crying out about when Amazon allowed the Kindle to kind of read books for you without buying the audio copy. It's not a little bit clear here, but it does say that it'll make collections accessible to users with print disabilities in the same way as other books covered under the settlement agreement. So clear there's some things in there as well. It looks like there's going to be a mechanism to review prices. So remember, there was kind of a shady, vague language about there being institutional subscriptions to the entire digitized corpus. So now they're going to have a kind of very specific mechanism here for establishing prices. And oh my goodness, there's a very long paragraph here about how they're going to adjust prices. So how, you know, for instance, if Google wants to raise the price for access to the entire in copyright and public domain corpus, how that will go about. Clearly there have been a lot of lawyers working overtime. There's a whole bunch of things in here for price caps and pricing reviews, user experience, etc. Wow. Okay. So we will post this so everyone can read through it, and we'll maybe review it, in more depth later on. But Tom, as you pointed out, and we'll link to this as well, I mean, Brewster Kahle of the Internet Archive had a very tough op-ed piece in the Washington Post yesterday, really sort of calling out both people in Congress and also those who are cooperating to Google to say, you know, this is really a troubling settlement and agreement, and that, you know, we really should push towards something that's truly public. And, you know, at the same time, we saw over the last couple of weeks that Microsoft is contributing $50,000 to the opposition to the Google book settlement. So this is all really heating up this summer.
Well, I think the summer is not a bad time to have it heat up when people aren't paying that much attention.
Right.
And I think, you know, Microsoft contributing money to that is probably just needling Google, because $50,000 would be, you know, one day of lawyers' fees and all
right,
of this.
Right. That's right. Okay. Well, we'll report back in a couple weeks, and as we read through, we'll have to get our legal division to read through all 36 pages of this. It's rather incredible, and has all kinds of definitions of what books mean and things like that. So that'll be our exciting. Well, it's a PDF, so you can put it on your Amazon Kindle DX and read it on a hot summer night.
The question is whether the legal document itself is covered under the definition of book. And is it covered right. by the settlement itself?
Well, right.
Have to.
Yeah.
And I'm also concerned that if I have the PDF and I might pass it on to a friend, would I be violating somebody's copyright?
Not if you take a Polaroid picture of it and then
pass them
under the analog loophole.
Well, Tom, since you've been away for a month or so, we'll give you the first pick of the episode, what did you find over the last month that you think our audience would be interested in? A link, piece of software, website?
Yep, it's actually a piece of software. It's called VirtualBox at virtualbox.org. And it's basically just a virtualization, an operating OS virtualization software. Something like if people have used VMware or on the Mac, VMware Fusion, so that you can run what it allows you to do is run another operating system on your box at the same time you're running your primary operating system. So I run Ubuntu as my primary operating system, and I've installed VirtualBox, and I can run actually I'm running the new Windows 7 in a virtualized window on my computer. And it's actually from what I've experienced, you know, I tried VMware Fusion. I tried another product for the Mac, but I've tried a couple of these packages that allow you to do this. And this is the best one I've tried. It works. It's like seamless, and it's free. And the other ones cost, you know, quite a bit of money. It was developed by Sun Microsystems. It runs on Windows, Linux, Macintosh,
yeah,
and Solaris.
Sun, right. Mm-hmm.
It's an easy download, a quick download, quick installation, and you just kind of like boot it up and install Windows or whatever as your secondary operating system you want, Ubuntu or another flavor of Linux. You just load it up there. It's super simple and really, really good, really snappy. I totally recommend it. Please save your money if you're looking to buy some virtualization software. Try VirtualBox first.
Well, this looks great. I've been meaning to try this, so it really works well then.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. It did for me on Ubuntu, and I'm guessing it probably does on Windows. I'd like to, you know, anybody in the audience who wants to try it on Mac, I'd love to hear how it goes for you. But yeah, it was really, really good.
Yeah, you know, at the Center for History and New Media here at Digital Campus headquarters, you know, we do a lot of testing on multiple operating systems of either websites and what they look like in different browsers on different operating systems, and also software, like a certain piece of software we'll talk about in a second, on multiple platforms. And so we've generally used Parallels, although some of us have been using VMware now more recently.
Right, Parallels is the other product.
Right. And, you know, these cost money and, you know, but they seem to work pretty fine. But if this works well, it'd be a great way if you want to try out, for instance, look at what your website looks at, like in IE8, you can't do that on a Mac without Windows. So you could download this, install Windows on the VirtualBox, and take a peek at what your site will look like on IE8. Thanks, Tom. Mills, should we announce what? We have a joint pick.
We do.
It is a piece of software that we've talked about before, of course, and is headquarters here at CH&M. Zotero 2.0 has been released to the public. Yay!
Well, I'll add my myself to that pick. I'll pick it too.
Okay, thank you. All right, we have a joint pick for the week. You've heard us blab on about Zotero, but this is a very big release. It includes really the full social online element. So not only can you back up your collection online, but you can share it with other people. You can join groups. And Mills, I suspect you have some ways that you might be using this in courses coming up.
Oh yeah, I mean I'm most excited about Zotero's teaching potentialities in this new version, because already, you know, I was just thinking this morning about the class I'm going to be teaching this fall on teaching history in the digital age, and I've got almost all of my readings are in some sort of digital format. So now I'm just going to park them all in my Zotero folder for that course, and my students will all have easy access to them, and it's going to be great. And they, you know, we're going to have every single one of the students is going to have their own Zotero space. And so I'm really excited about the ways that Zotero is going to really facilitate teaching with digital materials.
Yeah, I'm going to do the same thing. And so for those who haven't used Zotero before or are new to the podcast, it's at zotero.org. And on a basic level, it's a way to manage your research and keep track of citations. It's a little slide-up window that looks like iTunes and appears in your Firefox or Firefox-based browser. Tom, by the way, you'll be glad to know that it works on, what is it, Ice? It's not Ice Weasel anymore. What did it change to? There's an Linux version of Firefox now that's supported by the GNU group. Anyway, any Firefox based browser, and gives you a place to store things from the web browser, and of course it's able to pick up academic articles and books straight out of your web browser. And so now what's exciting about this is if you have a group for your class, you can, as Mill said, you can just drag and drop materials from your own Zotero interface into a group folder that will then propagate out to the rest of your class. You can take notes on it together. You can tag things together. So it really opens up, I think, an exciting world now of a kind of collaborative education and also scholarship, which is the part I want to emphasize here, that I think now we're seeing. I mean, this is pretty incredible. I don't know if I told you about this, Tom and Mills, but just in the first 3 days, we had over 500 scholarly groups formed on Zotero.org since the launch of 2.0. I should check on it now. It's probably even more. But I mean, this is everything from forestry to gender studies to all the natural sciences, and of course everything in history. We're now up to 780 groups 6 days into the launch of 2.0. Some of the recent groups, there's now a science and technology studies that has been launched, and some of these groups are open, so anyone can join them. You can also set up private groups, for instance, for your department or a science lab, and you can do kind of quasi-public-private, where you might have a group of scholars that works together to put a really good bibliography together, and then they share that with the world, so you don't have to let in anyone, but you can share your results with anyone.
Well, we're actually getting ready to do that. There are a group of us that are it's the International Society for the Scholarship of Teaching and Learning's history affiliate, and we have such a bibliography, but it's right now just sitting on a blog platform somewhere, and so somebody's going to migrate it over into a Zotero space right away, and that's going to be really great.
Great. So again, the best way to learn about this is to watch the video at on the homepage of Zotero.org, and maybe we'll have to set up a digital campus group here for links. I've been meaning to do that. We will do that right after we get off the podcast, so people can drag and drop links and join that group. Things that they want to see us discuss, you could just drag it into our folder and we'll see it. It will show up in our interfaces. And so we will see you at Zotero.org in the Digital Campus group and on Twitter at Digital Campus, and of course at our home base on the web, digitalcampus.tv, where every 2 weeks or sometimes 3 or 4 weeks, depending on if how we get around to it, there's a new episode of Digital Campus.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv, where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for